Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Joshua Zeidner. We're going to be talking about the tech industry as well as the recent Google memo case. Josh, great having you back on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Robert. Thanks a lot for having me again.
I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hey, nice to do another show with you, Josh.
Likewise, Sam. Always an honor.
Josh, you have a background in the tech industry. Can you talk about what your career background was and where you worked?
Sure. Well, as I said in the last show, I studied computer science and art and got a kind of a head start working in the internet field. I guess I was kind of a somewhat of a prodigy and got myself into some positions at a very young age, got some really good experience, which put my foot in the door into a lot of places, which I guess maybe the average late teens 20-year-old probably wouldn't.
And was this during the 90s, a tech boom?
Yeah, this was before 9/11, which, you know, later on I'll explain how that event sort of marked a pretty dramatic change in the way that the tech industry worked. So yeah, I was in the dot-com boom, but it was in the New York area, not the California area. But there were a lot of similar things happening on both sides of the country. I worked for a number of different firms. I worked for a company that was building the chat software for Lycos. So that was an early internet giant that I believe they got absorbed into Yahoo, although not completely sure on that one. From there, I sort of did a little bit of private consulting, and I ended up working for a German company by the name of Intershop. I worked for them for a brief period and then sort of did consulting for a whole bunch of different companies. One of the Dennis Publishing. I also worked for AIG on Wall Street for a while. So I got some experience in publishing, got some experience in finance. And from there, that's when that whole period that I explained in the last show, when I went to Israel and had a whole number of different experiences that didn't really relate directly to being a tech worker, although I did work in tech there as well. I worked in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv much later. So I got some experience in the tech sector in Israel, which has a lot of interesting aspects as well. And I also worked as a software developer in Germany and Australia. So that's mostly it. I've had a whole bunch of different gigs and work engagements since that period.
Would you say that the tech industry is pretty decentralized, or is so much of it concentrated in the Silicon Valley itself? And have you worked in the Silicon Valley, the region?
Yes, I worked for roughly about a year. I was situated in Palo Alto, and we were trying to put together a small startup company. And it didn't really work, didn't really kind of come together as we planned. And I sort of moved on from the Bay Area and moved elsewhere. Look for different opportunities.
Did working in the industry, I think we did touch on this on our last show, but how did it shape a lot of your outlooks that you have?
Well, I could honestly say after years of doing this probably about two decades now, I could say that it did not live up to the expectations that I initially had of what sort of opportunities would be available to someone like me. I think that a lot is set up to make it look as though there are things going on and there are opportunities available that really aren't. You know, it's a very stratified field. And, you know, a lot of the innovation really only happens through a small handful of people who sort of set the tune for what goes on. You really don't have a say. You know, you really don't have a way to deliver ideas to the marketplace. That was one thing that I sort of learned. It wasn't a very joyous kind of realization, but that's essentially what my experience was.
Was it more so that way in the United States, or did you have a more positive experience in Germany and Israel and Australia?
My experiences here were very positive up until 9/11. My experience working in Germany was very good. You know, their system and the culture of Germany in the workplace is probably the best I've ever experienced. And a lot of people say it's the best in the world, and I believe it. Israel is an interesting one. I think that, you know, the scene there, I think, in a lot of ways, you know, they portray it publicly as being very capitalistic and very innovation intense, where I don't think in a lot of ways it lives up to that. I think that the reason why it's like that is because Israel wants to be seen as being aligned with the American ideology, mostly for military reasons. So, you know, they prefer to be viewed in that way. When in reality, it's nothing like Silicon Valley there. Although they do have innovation, it doesn't really work the same way, and the culture is quite a bit different.
I guess going over these different countries, I was kind of interested in hearing about the differences more in detail. Where would you say is the strongest? So you would say Germany is the most technological innovation out of the countries that you were based in?
Yes. So the company, I connected to Germany because I was working for a German e-commerce company here in the U.S., and that sort of led to connections, and then eventually I got hired in a company in Germany. It was actually located in Hanover. And, you know, my experience working with Germans was, you know, they're very, very professional. They know how to act in a corporate environment. They know how to get the job done. They understand the value of specialization and expertise, and you don't really see that in every single situation, certainly most countries. And they really excel as far as that goes. You know, I think that Germany, you know, for years to come will continue to be a powerhouse when it comes to, you know, technology and 21st century production. They're going to be one of the best.
Yeah. It seems like when you talked about how, like, there's more specialization in Germany, where it seems like over here a single developer has to wear many hats. He has to be a back-end web developer, front-end web developer, and a DevOps guy. Like, he has to know all these different technologies that, like, aren't even related to each other.
Yeah, I mean, the whole field is really degraded. You know, I've watched it go from, you know, a workable, kind of vibrant sort of scene to something that's almost dead. You know, for you to be useful around here, again, the bar is so high because everything is just so scattered around and unstructured that, you know, it essentially like creates, it's the opposite of job creation. It's eroding, it's rotting, you know, from the inside. And, you know, why that is, it has a lot to do with those H-1B visas. I mean, they've really eroded a lot of the opportunities and the ways that the job market would be functioning otherwise. And sometimes I even suspect that was intentional. I think that, you know, that there was, it's kind of like class warfare, I think. You know, there was an agenda to deteriorate, you know, some of the economic opportunities for a given socioeconomic bracket to make sure that those people aren't threats to other people.
And the main argument that the proponents of the H-1B visas use is that we need, that there's a shortage of tech workers and that we need the more innovation. But basically, your two earlier statements basically debunked both those as outright lies.
Oh, sure. I mean, initially, so H-1B visa, the program began during the dot-com boom, and the justification was that we don't have enough good people here. And that flew, you know, at the time. And because there was a great demand, everybody was making a lot of money. Nobody was really complaining about lack of jobs. There was really lack of expertise. So adding those people in at that time actually created more jobs because it allowed us to do things here. But, you know, in today's environment, it's very much reversed because we have a lack of jobs now. The economy is somewhat anemic. So, I mean, just to give you a couple of the figures regarding H-1Bs, we're bringing in somewhere between 60 to 100,000 H-1B visas per year. And then there's other classes of visas like L-1s. So now keep in mind that this doesn't just mean a four-year worker. This typically means when someone is issued a visa, it very commonly turns into a green card scenario. So they become permanent workers. So we're bringing in, I don't know, I would say a conservative estimate, 70 or 80,000 full-time workers, middle-class jobs are going to foreigners every year. In addition to that, the companies that are filing for these visas, they're not even domestic companies. You have companies like Tata and Infosys, which are Indian companies. So they have a presence here.
Are you saying they're Indian companies operating in the United States, or is this outsourcing?
Right, exactly. So they're operating in the United States, and they're the ones applying for the visas. So they're bringing their own people, their own employees over from India and just transferring them over here under these visa systems. It's a complete and total violation of the initial intent of these programs. You know, the abuses had gone on for many, many years, and people kept pointing it out, and these complaints kept floating to the surface. But you know, I guess the problem was that there was nobody who was really who had the incentive to come up and say something. It resembles the illegal alien problem in a lot of ways, because there's really no party that was there to defend the interests of the average American and why it's bad. And it's the same thing with these H-1Bs.
I don't think tech workers are unionized.
No, not at all. And that's, again, another problem. I mean, we're in the 21st century. You know, this is a major component to our economy today. We're not doing industrial labor anymore. Virtually everybody I would say a good portion of today's workers, easily 30 to 40% fall under this category of tech worker, and they have zero representation. Again, I think it's a shortcoming of the Democrats. You know, I think ideally the Democrats should step in and create, agencies or just ideas. You know, just get the ball rolling in the conversation about how to do this right. You know, because we're not doing it right. We're getting scammed in every way imaginable by countries like India and China. You know, they are exploiting our system in a very, very destructive way.
So the one question I have is there still hope for the tech industry? Or, like, let's say if you're somebody that's trying to get into tech, like you're at the entry level, you're a junior developer or whatever, should you still be trying to get into the industry, or should you change your field?
Well, I would say if things remain the way that they are, and I think eventually, you know, there's going to be enough groundswell that you're going to get a political change. But if things did stay as they are, then no, don't get into this field, because there's nothing that's keeping your wages afloat. And, you know, doing tech work is tedious. It's very stressful. So in the end, I mean, it's not worth it. The situation is getting so bad that I'm seeing a lot of very talented people that are just dropping out because they just can't make it. It just doesn't make sense for them anymore, and that's a real tragedy, because you know, we're losing these American people who, you know, we could have these talented people right here in America making ideas, developing new markets for technologies, developing new concepts, but we don't have that anymore because those people no longer work in the field. You know, they go into service industry or they leave the country or something like that. That seems to be very common route these days, like do it from another country. And I think that's just ridiculous that, you know, we're importing these like 100,000 people in here from India, and meanwhile these guys are going to India so that they could work. It's just idiotic.
I mean, I agree, like because it seems like that's hard for tech guys to find stable work in the industry. It's all of it.
No
it's
doubt.
Like all of my work in tech has been contract, and the contracts have been like farly spaced in between. I have to like do side jobs in order to like keep my income, and I'm saying this as somebody who worked in the tech industry himself.
Sure. Well, I mean, I could say that there is a demand for this work, and there's always demand for software. You know, software development is very similar to law. There's always demand for it because software developers make their own demand. So, you know, there's really not the idea that there's not enough work for software developers. That's really a major misnomer, and sometimes that idea is raised. It's just not true. The whole concept of job generation software is very, very different from other typical industries.
I know one of the guests we had on, Corey Son, brought to attention this article by Razib Khan. And Razib Khan made the point that someone making $100,000 a year in Palo Alto is the equivalent of, I think he said, $16,000 a year in St. Louis.
I don't know if about that seems a little high to me, but the general idea, yeah, that's very true. I mean, the disparities are unbelievable. Basically, all the cards are stacked against regular people at this point. I mean, I feel like we're almost in another period that's similar to the age of the robber barons, you know, where there's a very, very small pocket of people that are making all the money and everyone else is just sort of has no rights because they have no money. You know, they're not really a full-fledged person anymore. And, you know, the economic burdens are so unbelievable that, you know, the average person is just strapped. You know, they're up to their chin in debt and all these other problems. And personally, I think they like it that way.
And there's a lot of these statistics on the whole H-1B issue. A lot of them are from Professor Norm Matloff at UC Davis.
I was aware of what Norm Matloff was doing almost a decade ago. He was one of the few people, I would say, he's a brave guy. Let's just say that. I mean, he was a singular voice for a very, very long time about the problems of H-1B visas. Nobody else was saying anything about it except for him. And he's really stood alone for a number of years, and he deserves a great deal of credit for that. I mean, pretty much everything he's ever said is now accepted as being true. You know, he should really be running for politics in California because that guy was looking out for all the Californians and for the job market in California when nobody else was doing it.
What are your thoughts on Trump's stance on the H-1B visas and the recent proposed immigration bill that Trump is supporting?
Well, I mean, first off, I think general immigration issues are really quite separate from H-1B issues. So to address the H-1B question first, you know, that was part of Trump's campaign promises. I mean, H-1B visas and the whole, you know, I guess we'll just call them professional visas, he promised to reform them. He wavered a little bit after he got elected, but not by much. I think that the critics of that were a little bit overly zealous and overly critical of Trump. It seems like he still wants to do something. He did do one thing, which was stop the Indian local corporations from getting those visas. So he did actually cut back the number of visas, but what he did was he said, like, companies like Tata and Infosys can no longer, or at least put limits on how many those companies can actually use. The thing is just such a horrible scam. I mean, they're really like exploiting this the cheap labor differential in a very like obtuse and exploitative way. It really, really needs to come to an end. It's international companies running cheap labor scams in our country, exploiting our, you know, visa programs. It's just so wrong. It seemed like Trump was aware of what was going on. So anyway, the second question on immigration, I think what he wants to do is the right thing to do. And, you know, there's a lot of other countries that have a similar program. You know, his idea is to have a point-based system. I remember when I was looking at Australian citizenship, they had a very similar, you know, I had to, like, you know, go through and analyze what I needed to do to get in there. And I think, you know, I'm pretty sure that his system is actually modeled on Australia's or maybe Canada's. And you need to have a point system. So you're judged based on what you're going to contribute to the economy. Whereas today, I don't even know the criteria that they use to bring people in here. It's obviously
Well, you're talking about the H-1Bs for regular legal immigration. The primary thing is family reunification.
Is that the primary principle that brings these people in here?
Well, that's the primary policy. And a lot of these countries, basically your extended family means like you import like an entire village or tribe.
Right, and that certainly goes on with H-1B visas. So like they'll bring one person will qualify for one of these jobs, and I'll talk a little bit about how that whole process works too. And that's like an utter joke. So you know, somebody qualifies for one of these jobs, and that entitles them to bring over their wife, all of their kids, oftentimes their elderly parents, And even, I don't know, I'm sure that there's all sorts of loopholes there too. So one H-1B visa is like bringing over, take all of those people, that's 60 to 100,000, multiply that by at least four or five. That's how many people we're bringing in our country on a regular basis, while we have this very severe unemployment problem with millennials.
Yeah, and originally the concept of having a mass exodus out of a region was, when it happened to Detroit, it was a product of Detroit's economy collapsing. But if you take the Silicon Valley region, that's supposed to be an immensely prosperous region, but you're seeing this massive exodus of people leaving.
Right. I mean, it's a question of how they measure prosperity, and they do it by GDP. So, you know, they're bringing in revenues, but who's actually prospering from these programs? And you'll see it's only the very, very, very wealthy people, you know, the ones who have excess capital. I mean, if you want to put it in terms of Marxism, they call it like the haute bourgeoisie. Those are the people who have great and large access to very large reserves of capital and can do, and they have certain like abilities and powers in a capitalist system. And those are the people that are benefiting from these programs, and no one else really. Now, to address the thing that I mentioned before, like how Indians get in here. So, you know, like they basically exploit the system from every angle you can possibly imagine. So one of them, there's requirements for H-1Bs about higher education. So they either have to have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. So the companies over in India, what they'll do is they have their own like accreditation centers that are like these joke schools. And, you know, they're basically like, you know, diploma mills. And they'll send these Indians through these diploma mills, get this fake accreditation, which allows them to get into the H-1B program. So they're not only that, they're bringing over people that might look on paper like they have experience, but in actuality, they have no experience at all.
So with the Trump's point system, he has a number of things. One of them is speaking English. And there's a different level. Like there's basic English, there's complete fluency, then having favorite like more points for higher income. He also favors people by age, so people between the age of like in their 30s are favored, and right. He discourages it would discourage people who are elderly. So it is.
Well, I'm not sure how that program works in conjunction with the H-1B program. So those people that come over that are, you know, connected in some way by relation to the H-1B recipient, I don't think that those even are characterized as immigrants per se. They're actually just considered to be part of the visa program. So I would not be surprised, and I don't know for sure, but I would not be surprised that even if we did have this immigration system, that those relatives would not even necessarily need to go through that process to get over here. I mean, whether or not Trump is going to do some omnibus bill and just kind of wipe the whole slate clean and restructure the entire way that people get into this country, that's, you know, that's a good question, because keep in mind that one thing falls under the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor, while another one falls under the jurisdiction of the Department of Immigration. So, you know, those two things don't necessarily work together.
I know his labor.
It's a mess.
Trump's labor secretary is some corporate shill. I forget his name.
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't follow that closely. I'm just kind of have a perspective on how the tech industry works. I mean, those political regions are very, very complex. I mean, the rules and regulations that govern those sorts of things are unbelievably complex. Most of the experts work for these corporations, so you know they're working on behalf of these people. I can't even identify a single person who's an expert in our immigration system who's not employed for the wrong, you know, not employed by the wrong people.
One thing about the H-1Bs you were talking about, it primarily benefits basically the billionaires, people worth over $100 million in the tech industry. Traditionally, it's been working class people opposed to manufacturing jobs and going overseas and opposed to immigration. This has a detrimental effect on the upper middle class. So it's interesting to see if these issues will change the political dichotomy. And this is kind of like what goes back to what we were discussing with Giovanni Donato the last time we talked.
Well, I think it's fairly, again, it's pretty complex, like which socioeconomic groups fall under, you know, the people who are going to be affected by changes in this. And even myself, I felt over the years that I sort of straddled the line between the classes of people that had enough money where they didn't really consider themselves to be a laborer, and then the classes of people who do consider themselves to be a laborer. I suppose it depends on how much resources you have available, you know, how much you actually bring in per year, you know, what sort of assets you were kind of handed, either through inheritance or otherwise. I was kind of like somewhere in the middle of laborer and capitalist. You know, I've certainly had my share of access to money, but it's never been really that enormous. So I'm kind of considering both sides of it. You know, what, it's really hard to say, like, what, you know, what the change that Trump is going to propose, like who it's going to affect. Now, it's the same thing with illegal aliens. You know, there's a certain group of people that resist any kind of reform in that area because, you know, they employ these people. They make a great deal of money off of them. Something that, you know, your listeners should understand about H-1Bs, if you've never had any exposure to either working with them or any exposure to the issue at all, you know, we like to believe, the prevailing idea is that they're here because they're talented. That's not true. They're here because they're cheap. And it's not only cheap, they're also pliant. So they call it like the handcuffed, I think is the word, or jailed employee, because there's all these rules that surround the H-1B visa that prohibit the visa recipient from moving, for instance. Like, they can't move. They have to live in one place. And if the boss can cancel the visa at any time, so the boss has far more control over the employee in question. That employee also doesn't have as many rights as an American does. So, you know, they can't file for harassment or they can't file for unjust termination. So there's a lot of things that look attractive to an employer, but by American standards, that's like exploitation. You know, the ideas that go all the way back to the Dune Deal and unionization and all that. It's really almost a unionization problem. I mean, a lot of these old ideas about why we unionized in the first place and, you know, what those early labor movements are really about, they seem to be resurfacing in a new way, you know, for a 21st century way. Because people are starting to realize once again that they're laborers. Whereas in the 90s up until maybe like the 2010s, I think people kind of believed that they were beyond that. You know, those sorts of problems didn't affect them. And now there's a lot of people that are living in poverty and they really have no other choice. You know, they have to figure out a way to finance basic American life. And that's a lot of people today. That's a great deal of people.
What do you think about the proposal to nationalize social media? I know there was a recent op-ed of Steve Bannon coming out and proposing that, and basically nationalizing it as a utility and guaranteeing free speech. I totally support this, but ironically, that's traditionally been a leftist issue.
I think that it is inevitable that this is going to happen. If you remember, Trump also, this was one of Trump's minor talking points, although it was there. You know, he was complaining about the idea of regulating the internet. And, you know, a lot of people kind of get a little bit terrified of that idea. But, you know, we're at a point where the internet's just gotten so extremely ridiculous and some of the things that go on there that I don't think we're going to be able to avoid it. We're going to need something like a new agency, like a department. Maybe it'll even go under the FCC. It's possible that the FCC may expand, you know, its jurisdiction over internet content. I mean, the FCC certainly has jurisdiction over the hardware conduits. And, you know, if you remember from the days of the information superhighway, you know, there was quite a bit of structure, statutory structure about, you know, how these conduits can be laid down, who can charge for them, what they can do. But now we have these things like search engines and social media that are governing our lives and really influencing our lives very, very deeply. Some people's entire livelihoods are based on these things. And
yeah, because Google can do some, they can mess with the search optimization. So if your website is a dissident website, it can be lowered.
no doubt about it.
Search engines, there's so many different things they can do.
Oh, Google is just has so much influence and power at this point. It's unbelievable. It's not only in America, it's worldwide. I was reading something the other day that you'd probably find interesting. And it was on one of those, there's quite a number of projects, like open source projects, that are attempting to create technologies that can help, like, break up the monolithic power that Google has. And I was looking at one of them, and this guy's describing a major problem that a lot of people don't even see. He was saying that, an issue is that, say you have a tech company, and they're working on a very complex product that's secretive, and that's a big part of their model, that no one can understand what they're doing until they bring it to market and get it patented and everything. Keep in mind that Google has all of these search query records. So they see every single little thing that your employees are searching for. And it wouldn't take much effort for somebody at Google to just take a look at that and then, infer what sort of thing your company is working on. They have so much oversight and power over the U.S. and elsewhere at this time. It is unreal how much knowledge they have on each and every person. Even people like Julian Assange had come out and said that this is a big problem and we need to fix it. It wasn't just Google; it was Facebook as well, and Twitter is probably on that list, although they're a minor player.
Did you follow that bill that? I think it's called the Protect IP Act. It was sponsored by a Democratic senator that would prevent search engines from selling search engine history to advertisers. And Trump, I think, either got the Republicans in Congress, I think, voted to repeal it.
Yeah, I mean, but that's not the first time that those sorts of protections have been proposed on either side of the divider. So, I wouldn't necessarily condemn Trump for batting that one down, because there may have been something else in that bill that he didn't like.
The fact is,
you need a bipartisan kind of platform that defines exactly what a person's rights are in this regard, and define checks and balances to keep companies like Google in check, because it has gone far beyond. It's not only little things like are they spying on your personal life? Yes, they are definitely doing that. Are they spying on your commercial operations? Yes, they're doing that. They're also able to modify the election process. So it becomes a threat to the very democratic principles that our entire government is based on. For instance, Google or Facebook, and they trade information. They're not separate companies. They're brokering.
Well, YouTube, I know YouTube is part of Google.
Yeah, YouTube is 100% part of Google. It's not even it's not even like a clandestine thing. It's fully out in the open part of Google. But to complete my thought, Google, they can track exactly like what interest is in specific policies, and what that interest is according to demographics, and they could use that to engineer outcomes of elections. It's a scary thing. It's hard to say this problem, but it exists nonetheless. So, what are we going to do about this? The more people get online and submit every little piece of information in their lives, inadvertently or not, these data banks are going to be just this massive threat to individual freedom. And I think Assange is kind of working on that premise as well, too. He came out and he said Facebook is one of the worst spying devices ever invented. And Google and Facebook, they were initially formed with money from a company called InQtel, which really is they get their money from our defense budgets. So to say that they're not tangled in with U.S. intelligence, I have to be careful what I say, but to say that they're not in cahoots with those parties is really, that's a foregone conclusion at this point.
Yeah. Gets back to the thing is, a lot of these libertarian types will freak out when you talk about nationalizing a social media or Google. But the thing is, they're already kind of these quasi they're already in bed with the whole surveillance state, and they basically, there's no privacy whatsoever.
None.
So there's basically turning into a public utility would be a vast, maybe it wouldn't be perfect, but it'd be a vast step in the right direction.
Right. I mean, I agree that it's got to go under the aegis of some sort of agency of some kind. Whether or not we classify it as utility, that's hard to say because, you know, the internet world is still moving pretty fast as well, too. So that always tends to offset, you know, the government's desire to sort of regulate and establish rights and guidelines for operators. You know, things like cable TV or broadcast TV. You know, the inputs and the parameters for those technologies are pretty simple, but for the internet, I mean, it's always going to be this realm of like anarchy to some degree. But I think certainly, you know, in this day and age with social media, yes, we need some kind of power to come in and say, this is okay, this is not okay. You know, you have kids killing themselves from stuff that kids are posting online. I mean, that should be an indicator right there that things are going a little bit too far.
Well, isn't that like, aren't we stepping in the SJW direction by going after things like that? Like, you know, like kids killing themselves over things that kids post. I mean, other than like, let's say something blatant, like go kill yourself, but said in an unironic manner. But I mean, like, people could kill themselves. Oh, it's possible that people could kill themselves over anything anybody says.
Yeah.
Well, there was a case just recently with that girl, you know, who was texting her boyfriend to kill himself, and then he did it. Now she's in jail.
Yeah, but that's different because she was insisting that he kills himself. I mean, I'm talking about...
I mean, your point's taken. I understand, you know, where you're going. You're like saying that, you know, the moment that we kind of police speech on the internet, then, you know, we're stepping into, you know, that bizarro world of SJW land, which we've already deemed to be a totally unlivable place. Yes, you know, you're 100% right. But and I'm going to explain something that I even touched on with Robert earlier today, which was the safe harbor law. And what, you know, why the internet is what it is today. So, I mean, years ago, like not even that many years after the commercial internet was deployed and everyone started getting internet connections, they invented something called the Safe Harbor Law. And that is basically the law that says that if someone posts something on your website, then the owner of the website is not liable for the content. All right. So I could go on to Facebook. I can write up something about Sam and say, Sam is a dirty bastard and, you know, he did all these things, right? So in that case, you know, it would be libelous information if I said something like that on the internet, right? I made up some story about you that you did something really bad, okay?
Right, but that would already fall under laws against slander and you could already sue me.
No. I can only sue. See, this is how the safe harbor law works. Before Safe Harbor, then I could sue the owner of the website. I would be able to sue Facebook.
And the Safe Harbor law that was written in 1998, so that was before social media became big.
Right. If you ask me, they established that law just so they could have social media. I believe that it was one of the things that these lobbyists got together and decided that they wanted to create this thing, social media, and you know they established these laws to make sure that someone like Facebook would not be liable if somebody I mean, can you imagine if Facebook existing if every single thing that some jerk posted on the internet
Someone
else? No, it would be totally insolvent. You know, it would not even work. So, you know, they established this thing, which made it possible to do things like Twitter and Facebook. Now, here's the interesting part. You know, this idea prior to Safe Harbor Law, have you guys ever registered for a domain name before, like a DNS registration?
Yeah, for my website.
Okay, and you did it yourself. You didn't have like a specialist do it for you, so you have some familiarity with the technicality.
Yeah, with the company.
Okay, so. You know, one of the things that you do is you figure out what your domain name is going to be, you pay the price, and then you put your name on the registration, right? So I mean, that was the way that DNS was designed, so that there is the liable party for whatever content and information that is put under your domain name is very, very, very clear to the world. And, you know, this group created this international legal structure to make sure that, you know, in every jurisdiction, every country, and each country behaves in a slightly different way. Like, for instance, the Netherlands is a good example. Like, they don't have the same kind of laws that we have here in the U.S. But what it did was it established this sort of hierarchy of like culpability and liability for whatever it is that's put on these sites. And that idea, you know, of having a kind of designated, like responsible party for whatever goes on your site, that is consistent with hundreds of years of libel and defamation law. So in other words, before the internet, and still exists today, you write something in a book and you write something that, and it says something that's not true and damaging to someone else, you can get sued. Right. As we all know,
saying
on the internet,
in a book, the publisher could get sued as well as the writer.
Sure. It's a little bit more complex than that, but, you know, I'm simplifying it. Basically, you know, the responsible party can get sued. Same thing for a newspaper. The laws are a little bit different in that case. Same thing with TV. I mean, they have rules that are appropriate and designated according to each one of these mediums. So
sort of like with the FCC, when Howard Stern, he said something on air and a Queer Channel was getting fined.
Sure. That's happened many, many times where, you know, some like one of these, talk show hosts or something says something and, you know, it becomes this, it becomes like a legal liability for the owner of the, the broadcasting channel. And that was a big part of the business of doing media. And then, you know, they invented the safe harbor law, and suddenly they created this space, you know, in the country and even around the world where anybody's saying anything that they want that is not consistent with our ideas about civilization and it never has been. And, it's only been around, as Robert said, I think it was in 1998 that it was first drafted. You know, it's been around for what, about 10, 15 years. And it's been, ever since this thing's been around, it's like insane. You know, some of the things that we're witnessing happening, people killing themselves. Look at what happened in our last election, you know, with all of this utter nonsense being published on the internet. Everything from Hillary is a reptilian from another planet to Trump has, you know, I won't even mention some of the things that they said about him. This new law of the internet and the fact that people just implicitly trust what they see on there, it is creating this really toxic information environment. And it's all due to this one law that the social media companies put in place.
Have you read the book Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine?
I've read most of it. I highly recommend that book, by the way.
What are some of the key insights that the book puts out that you haven't mentioned so far?
Well, he points out, a lot of the facts about what, you know, how these big internet media companies, Google, Twitter, Facebook, those are the three main ones standing at this point. Yahoo's just kind of like a joke. I mean, they're not really relevant. But he talks a lot about the facts about, you know, how they were formed. He goes into detail about the whole InQtel thing, you know, about how Google and Facebook maintain relationships with intel agencies, you know, how they're using your information to profit. They're using their information. They're using your information against you. They're using your information using what they call passive surveillance, which, you know, a common thing that I'll raise with people and I'll tell them, you know, Google's watching you or Facebook's watching you. And the answer to them is always, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. No problem with that. And, you know, maybe they're the sort of kind of a law-abiding milquetoast kind of citizen that doesn't really rile anything up. And that's fine. Maybe it's not a personal threat to them. But the issue is that they have a very large database of what everyone's doing. So they can do things with that. They can predict things. They can engineer outcomes, social outcomes. And it poses a whole class of threats to our basic notions of freedom that we don't really even understand yet. So Yasha Levine goes into some of that stuff in this book. I highly recommend it if you're interested in the subject of the internet giants and surveillance.
Does it go beyond what Edward Snowden exposed?
Levine's book? I wouldn't say in any significant way, no. It's more like an introduction to, these sorts of issues. He's actually a very lefty guy. I mean, he's a critic of Trump.
He's affiliated with, do you know Mark Ames?
I know who the person is, and he was with that company, the magazine Exile or something. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, the one, I think it's based in Russia. Mark Ames wrote this book called Going Postal, where he blames mass shootings on economic changes.
Okay. Well, Yasha was also writing for Pando for a while too. I'm sure you know that magazine. I would assume.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and Pando was kind of. They were somewhat renegade for a while too, and he found a home there for a bit, and then I think he's now writing by himself and working on his book. I don't really know him personally. I'm just familiar with his work, and I'm an admirer of what he does.
What are your thoughts on the recent Google memo where there was this employee at Google where there was some information? He was making some comments about women in tech, and he ended up losing his job. Same as James Damore.
Yeah, James Damore. My thoughts are this. I think that this sort of coming to the fore is really a long time coming. These kinds of things that he had pointed out. And it's really funny, the amount of blog postings and 1 hour long YouTube discussions about this memo. And very few people actually read the memo, which is really not that long. I'd say most of the people that I spoke to read at least 10 or 20 blog articles, but didn't actually bother going into what this person actually wrote. And by the way, it was very simplistically written. It was not abstruse academic language. He stated what his points were in a very lucid, very simple way. But and basically what he had said was this. He said that, there are differences between men and women, and that, we need to stop assuming that there is equivalence between the two sexes. That was roughly the extent. And he's also made a couple of notes about you should let conservatives have a say, too. I don't know whether or not Damore is a conservative himself. I'm going to guess he isn't.
Yeah, it's like a pretty mild... He's a mild-mannered guy.
Yeah, he's not an extremist in any way. As a matter of fact, the memo itself almost apologizes for what he's saying, and he does still the feminist ideas, about gender roles and gender stereotyping. He makes sure that he continues to hold on to that and embrace that while putting forward this basic idea that this notion of equivalence is actually extremely damaging, and he's right. And I'll tell you guys something. I mean, this stuff is a long time coming. I mean, I've been working in this field for years and years and years. I'm not the only one that has complained about, these kinds of problems that, women, I think in a lot of ways, I think some of our idealistic, our idealism about gender roles and the possibility of them being equivalent is not quite living up to what we had imagined. And that's probably the best way I can put it. Certainly.
Well, here we go. He has a recent op-ed, James Damore in the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. The op-ed is pretty mild. It's pretty mild op-ed, but primarily his main point is that there should be freedom of speech, and that Google demands a sort of strong sense of consensus. One other interesting point that comes out of this is you see this political alliance between the cultural left and the corporations. And for people that we kind of talk to, that's kind of common knowledge. I think from your average person on the street, they think that leftists, or cultural leftists, I should say, and corporations are enemies.
Right, or that these left-wing ideas are meant to protect us from the corporations, when in reality they're actually allied with them. And I think that sort of strand of thinking is something that really underlied maybe the last 20 years of American life. We had this thing called liberalism, and it looked like it was palatable, and it looked like it was acceptable, and looked like it was even beneficial, but it turned out it was none of those things. And I think really people are just starting to really wrap their head around exactly what it is and where it came from. And that seems to be accounting for a large portion of this kind of energetic behavior in the politics realm, especially in what they call the alt-right. You know, if you notice, like, the alt-right people all just instantly sort of grab the guy and, you know, come on over and have a beer. You know, we're best friends now. And he's, you know, he's doing appearances on all of these talk shows and everything. And I think he's a perfectly stand-up guy. You know, it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with him. And I wish him very well. I hope he does really, really good. I mean, even Julian Assange offered him a job. So, you know, maybe it'll even work out for him better from an economic standpoint. I mean, he's obviously famous now, so good for him. And I think his intentions were 100% authentic. I don't think any of this was doctored or astroturfed or anything like that.
There was another case in the Silicon Valley where this woman got this man fired at a convention for making something, a very mild joke. Forget what. Do you remember that?
Was it the Python? You might have been talking or something.
The one on LinkedIn. So there was this one. There was this one issue, and that was about. It was roughly 5 years ago, maybe perhaps even more.
No, this was the last year.
Oh, okay. Well, there was one famous story on LinkedIn, and this is pretty good. You know, this top exec or something. He literally just all this guy said was, "That's a really nice picture you have in your LinkedIn profile." So, you know, this female lawyer decides to basically just destroy this guy's life. You know, and she uses the sexual harassment card and basically just, you know, steamrolls the guy, destroys him simply because he said something nice. I mean, you know, I'm not going to get into these. Go ahead.
That is absolutely insane. Just for saying her LinkedIn profile picture looks nice.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a lot of people have noted, they're creating this, like, death trap, hostile environment for men in the workplace. And this needs
exactly.
to be fixed.
It's like the corporate environment pretty much turns every man there into a stereotypical beta male.
Like, or a sexual predator. I mean, you're either one of those two things. Notice that. Of the two characters you're allowed to be, both of them are constantly thinking about sex all of the time, right? Like, that's the way that they model male behavior. You're not allowed to be a coworker because that takes away power from women. You know, that's the feminist agenda. If they don't want to be around men, they shouldn't be in the same place, right? I mean, if you're saying that for me to be around you, I mean, I basically have to accept this like social system that is, it's like damned if you do, damned if you don't, and right. It's a huge penalty to me. That's like pointing a gun at my head. It's basically saying I can't work here in those words.
Yeah,
roughly.
It's
would
like
you say
so
this is worse in the United States, or when you were working abroad, do you have these same problems? Obviously, well, Germany's pretty bad. I know they're censoring, they're pushing Facebook to censor politically incorrect comments on Facebook, but did you encounter any of that in either Germany or Israel?
I would say, I mean, for Germany with the gender stuff, it's less. You know, they seem to be a little bit less insane there, although they are moving in that direction.
So Germany's not on the level of Sweden?
No. They're still somewhat still kind of situated in these traditional outlooks, although it is moving in that, you know, the vector is towards that. You know, how quickly they move or whether that changes remains to be seen. Israel, I had one of the worst office experiences of my life when I was working there. I actually worked for a woman CEO. And, I mean, this person fulfilled basically every single negative stereotype about women bosses that I can possibly think of. She was incompetent. You know, she got her money because she's a woman. And what does she do the moment she gets the money? She hires all men, you know. Because she knows that men are actually going to get the job done. You know, if she really believed in equality, why didn't she hire other women to do the work? So, and I mean, this person was an utter sociopath. I don't know any other way to describe her. You know, she, everything that came out of her mouth was a lie. I was only there for about 2 weeks and then I moved on. But, and the only reason I'm relaying this story is because, you know, Israel as I even noted in the last time we spoke, it is one of the worst, most feminist countries in the world, I would say.
Yeah, that's interesting because in Sweden, per se, feminism is linked to being to like globalism and being in favor of Islamic immigration. But would you say in the case of Israel, is it sort of like the – do they link feminism to nationalism, like the Arabs are misogynistic, so we have to adopt this version of nationalism that incorporates feminism?
That's a good question, you know, because there's that obvious tension there between feminism and Islam, right? So, you know, one would think that it sort of polarizes and then Israel ends up being on the side of very extreme feminism, and that may be a contributing factor. You know, you do occasionally hear from Israelis that, you know, they reiterate this idea that, oh, we're not Arabs. You know, we don't do that. We don't do that to our women, and we don't act that way. And, you know, so certainly this idea is there, and that may be the reason why. It's just totally, insanely, ridiculously, you know, feminist-oriented place to the point where you can't really even live. You know, I've even spoken to some of the people that run the MGTOW group in Israel. He's told me stories about how things work over there. It is crazy. You know, and by the way, I mean, Israel has another good example of, you know, this like group dynamics with both genders, because, you know, they have the IDF and there's women in the IDF, as we all know. We've all seen these pictures of these girls in bikinis with machine guns. But, you know, what they don't talk about is how women actually behave in these combat situations. And this has been an ongoing issue.
I know Martin Van Creveld has written about this.
For the IDF or for the American?
Yeah, about the IDF specifically.
Right, because remember, I mean, we have all these problems are in any military that has, you know, like both genders. But it's especially a problem in Israel because everyone is conscripted there, including the women. And they make an attempt to integrate them together. And I mean, you could read some of these articles about their experiences of being in a combat unit with women and how utterly unreliable they are. And, you know, how much they basically just fail at every single thing. Now, I mean, when you're on the job, it's okay because you can just sort of shift the money around, right? I mean, typically the way that it'll work, if a woman's not pulling her weight, they won't fire her because of diversity. They'll just sort of move the money. You know, they'll take the money away from the average like white guy typically, and then move it over there, and then everything's okay. Now, when you're in a combat scenario, you know, you're talking about people's lives on the line. If a woman was freaking out, or you know, she can't emotionally cope, or she can't physically cope with some sort of issue that's happening, you know, in a tense combat environment. So, you know, I mean, if you really want to understand group dynamics like that, look at the military, and basically all you ever need to know you can find in these IDF groups. They're even thinking about taking the women out. There's some factions in Israel that are saying no more women in the military, and instead of military conscription, they want to send them to a community service for 3 years while the men do the combat roles, which probably is a good idea.
Back to the topic of Silicon Valley. One of the key points is that it's not really living up to all its hype, and it's sort of social contract with the state of California. I know there was this billionaire, Tim Draper. He proposed to break up California into six different states. And I know a lot of people in the audience are kind of sympathetic to the idea of secessionism or pan-secessionism, but he carved it out specifically so that the Silicon Valley would be the richest state, and they get their own two personal senators. In this fictional hypothetical state called the Silicon Valley, it would basically be all the Bay Area counties, with the exception of, I think, basically most of the Bay Area counties, and I think also Monterey. But it'd be the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest states in the country, at least, plus they get their own senators. But it kind of goes back to the hype. And it's not just the effect that it has on the rest of the state of California, just sort of the quality of life for your average person living in the region. It's supposed to be this area of immense wealth, sort of a liberal utopia, but it more resembles a high-tech version of the Robert Irwin age.
Well, I mean, for starters, Tim Draper, I mean, he's kind of a P.T. Barnum character, so, you know, take his statements with a grain of salt. I mean, I think in general that Californians really need to know that Silicon Valley is not really living up to its claims. And, you know, the, again, a libertarian will jump in here and say, well, what do they, you know, what do they owe you? But I mean, the fact is that Silicon Valley benefits from a great deal of tax rebate programs and visa programs and all sorts of things that, you know, the people of California and U.S. citizens give them, based on the fact that they're supposed to be providing jobs, which they're not doing. So, you know, I think there's a very clear kind of exploitation going on, and that really, really needs to be addressed, especially at this point in time when you have a pretty serious poverty and unemployment problem. You know, these kids, the millennial kids and the younger kids, they need jobs. They need lives. We don't need more visas. We don't need more of this nonsense and making the software companies that spy on us or cryptocurrency scams. I mean, even some of the major people like Mark Andreessen are in on these cryptocurrency scams, which, by the way, you know, this is a really interesting one. Maybe we can end with this. So what these new cryptocurrency companies are doing is, you know, they're taking in VC money, and it works under the VC structure where you get certain tax, certain kinds of like, there's a certain tax structure to it that's generous, you know, to the investor. So the money goes in, and it's instantly that money moves into the crypto world where it becomes, it's basically embezzlement. And it goes, you know, it turns into bitcoins or some other kind of coin that they invented. And then they write it off as losses on the investment side. It is a massive scam. And even some of the big names are doing this right now. I won't say who, but it is going on. So I think that that's the final chapter in this whole Silicon Valley scam story. You know, it's not, we're not too far off from the people just storming the gates and making, and kind of, you know, laying down a new law. You know, these people are getting rich, not because they're geniuses. They're getting rich because they're ruthless. You know, they don't have any scruples, and they know how to exploit things like tax programs, and they know how to exploit things like visa programs. We don't need those people.
So yeah, do you think Silicon Valley is finished?
I think it's just all, I mean, the basic, look at Google, right? I mean, what is their basic technology? It's search, right? You know, performing that basic function is not that hard. In fact, there are open source softwares out there that do most of this stuff. There's a project out there called Nutch. And I believe the guy who started it came from Google. And it can do this basic search function. Google just wants to make people believe that, you know, they have kind of like the World's Fair mentality, like this, like technological wonderland, you know, like they're delivering something of such great value and enhancing all of our lives. And they do a little bit of that, but most of what they do, 90% of what they do is not that.
You made this a point, you touched on it briefly on our Giovanni Donato show, but you said this period where there was immense technological innovation in the 90s, it was because all these middle-class people had access to capital, but now that access to capital is limited, that affects the innovation in tech?
Absolutely. And, you know, I lived through that period, and there was a palpable feeling like we were about to just take over. You know, like this, we all thought these old money people were almost comical, and that it was just a matter of time before, you know, we would be storming.
The big thing was like people were rebelling in the tech industry. They thought like we were not like the 1980s businessmen who wore suits and ties. We were all casual.
Oh, absolutely. This work casual thing. I remember when that started. And remember, I mean, like in the 90s, we emerged from this, you know, mainframe culture, you know, where computers were the central monolithic thing. And then Microsoft came along and they sort of revolutionized that. Or really Apple did. I mean, I would probably credit Steve Jobs with that one. And then later on, the internet came out, and then Google sort of pioneered and typified that whole movement. So it was very revolutionary, but, you know, I think that today these, you know, the casual work people, I think that they are the actual fascist overlords, and, you know, the conservatives are actually the underdogs.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Joshua Zeidner for being on. It's been an excellent show.
You're very welcome, and thank you, Robert, for doing this show.
And also thanks, Sam Kevorkian.
Thank you.